on the spot.
Yeah, we're waiting.
Yeah, now I'm on the spot trying to figure out a way to start this fucking episode. I'm like, what's something funny I can say? And Bailey's just like,
dance.
Dance, clown, dance.
Say something funny, funny man.
I'm like, I don't fucking have anything.
Make me laugh or I'm not reading the notes.
Jesus. Well, it is steak and blowjob day, but you had all the steaks you could eat.
Oh my God, I'm just missing that.
That portion?
And I don't have a boyfriend though, so guess I'll have to find a hobo.
I think you just go home and brush your teeth and really get that back part, and then you'll be good.
Yeah.
Just smack that uvula with the toothbrush.
And just be like,
yeah, I want you to touch that dangly thing that's swinging the back of my throat.
Yep.
Welcome, everyone, to Creeps in the Crypt.
You can even sing that while you do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Christian giving us the gluck gluck early on.
Mm. Yes, indeed. And hopefully me later. Anyway, welcome to Creeps in the Crypt, everybody. As always, I'm Eric, and I'm joined by
a girl who did not have steak, so I feel like that doesn't apply to me, Christian. You know,
steak was on the table. There's two in the fridge. You're like,
what, are you just going to like throw this on there
tonight?
And a girl named Bailey who did have steaks.
Oh, but no blowjob.
Oh my gosh, you guys, they forgot to charge me for my meal.
What?
They only charged me for my two glasses of wine and my creme brulee dessert. They did not charge me for my meal. And I was like, please don't notice. Please don't notice. And I was like, nobody say a fucking word.
Oh, yeah.
And
what?
Yeah. Like, my bill was $28.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
And I had two glasses of wine, creme brulee, and the all-you-can-eat.
If you've never had a Brazilian all-you-can-eat steakhouse, they are phenomenal.
So good.
We have tricked Jackson into that he is what age?
11.
Yeah. He's been 11 for like... Or no, what is it? 7. That's what it was before.
Well, he was 7, but now they've upped it to 11.
Yeah, forever he was 7 years old.
So he thinks he's...
No, he would just say it.
Oh.
Like, so he can eat for free.
Are you gypsy fucking rosing him right now?
No. We were like,
I mean, if it saves me money.
He just knew. He, like, when they would ask him, he's like, I'm 7. They're like, yeah, okay.
7. There was one time where we're like, we can't pass him off as 7 anymore. He hit that first growth spurt. So he's like, I'm 9. And they're like, how much? They're like, does he eat a lot? And I was like, no.
How much 9 are you?
Yeah. They're like, does he eat a whole lot? Because the kid's like a bird.
Yeah.
Except when he's there. And then he's like, eats like a man.
Well, so he does eat a whole lot.
Oh, he does. Yeah. But I didn't tell them that.
They have a new, I don't know when the last time you were there was, but they have grilled mozzarella cheese.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Fucking dude, that I was talking about that in the group chat
today.
What? Really?
Yeah.
I wasn't reading them.
I know.
Awkward.
But anyway, guys, we're here to talk about not steaks and blowjobs and getting deals under the table.
Not this time.
Not this time. We're here to talk about the Texas killing fields again.
What a transition that you made there.
I know. I got the segues for days. But yeah, we're going to talk about Texas Killing Fields Part 2. We're going to wrap this series up today. It's probably going to be a longer episode. So, without further ado, Bailey, do the voodoo that you do.
I will. Okay. So, where we last left off, we had just introduced Clyde Hedrick in the story of the Texas Killing Fields. In early 1984, he met a woman named Ellen Beeson of Friendswood, Texas. The night that she met Clyde Hedrick, he and Ellen had gone out to a swimming hole. According to Clyde, she said she wanted to go skinny dipping. He said that he said that he looked out and she was floating on top of the water. She drowned, so he panicked and put her in the back of his truck, intending to bring her to the hospital, but then decided to dump her body and hid her body under a couch and some tires. Because Ellen's body was so badly decomposed due to extreme exposure to the elements and being in a wet area, the medical examiner couldn't determine manner or cause of death. So the most that Clyde could be charged with was tampering of evidence and abuse of corpse. He was fined $2,000 and 1 year in prison. But here's the only good thing about this. With Clyde being a suspect in Ellen Beeson's death slash murder, allegedly, he now becomes a suspect in the Texas Killing Fields murders. In September 1984, 16-year-old Laura Lynn Miller, a sophomore at Clear Creek High School.
Say that three times fast.
Clear Creek High School. Clear Creek High School. Clear Creek High School.
Okay, you did it.
Get fucked. Went missing. She had a knack for music. She loved Linda Ronstadt and Fleetwood Mac, same girl. But when she started having seizures, it changed her life drastically, and she began to struggle with depression. She'd made a couple of attempts at suicide, but they were unsuccessful.
Why do I feel like that mission will be completed, though?
But not on her terms.
Not on her terms, no.
So then she started hanging out with a group of teenagers who were doing drugs. She was last seen on September 4th when she asked her mom to drive her to use a payphone at a nearby convenience store to call her boyfriend to ask if he wanted to come over to their house. They had just moved into their new home and it didn't have a landline yet. Laura Lynn's mom, Jan, hollered out to her, "Hurry up, I'm going to be late for work." Laura responded that she wanted to talk to Vernon, her boyfriend, for a little while longer and that she would walk back home herself because it was just a short distance, less than half a mile from the gas station where the payphone was to their house. Laura Lynn never made it home that day. It just so happens that in the same payphone that Heidi Fey was seen using before she went missing back in October 1983.
So just a quick breakdown for our Gen Z listeners. A payphone was a booth you would put change in to make phone calls. And a landline was a phone that was connected to the wall of your house.
And there was a line.
And there was a phone line that ran to it.
In the LAN.
Yes. Not these fangled wireless phones you kids have today.
Right. So a community-wide search ensued to find Laura Lynn, but there were no clues or leads to figure out where she went after using that payphone. Police initially wrote her off as a runaway, despite the fact that she needed her medication for her epilepsy.
That's what all the cops at this time were doing, though.
Yeah.
Because this is like late. So since like the 60s, kids would just like disappear because they'd run away. So the cops were just always quick. Just be like, oh, run away. She's probably fine.
No life 360 or find my friends.
No.
Nope. So on February 2nd, 1986, about a year and a half, 17 months to be exact, after Laura Lynn went missing, four boys were out riding their dirt bikes near the oil field when they smelled something awful. Obviously, boys being boys, they went to figure out what the smell was. Turns out it was a decomposing body. It was in the same area, less than 50 yards away, where Heidi's body was found. There was a blue plaid shirt that was found near Laura's body. It had some stains on it, and back in the 80s, they didn't have DNA just yet. So they just tagged it as Laura's DNA.
Dude, I wonder if this kid's trying to jump in on their bikes.
The body?
Yeah.
Eric! That's pretty fucked up. See how much air up. I can get. Only your brain would come up with some shit like that.
Thank you. Thank you.
He should be put in like a little jar and studied.
Honestly, whenever you expire, we're going to have your brain, okay?
That's fine. Just use my body in like a skate ramp or something.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we're going to try to get some air on that shit.
Yeah, get some air on it.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that South Park episode where Cartman tries to jump the homeless on his bicycle. That's where my brain went.
I see.
Yes.
Wow. All right. Okay, so police got to the scene fairly quickly, but the body wasn't able to be identified, so they just referred to her as Jane Doe. Once they started investigating the scene to maybe find some clues as to who the body belonged to, they found another set of remains. These belonged to that of Laura Lynn Miller that was about 20 yards away from the Jane Doe remains. They were fairly close together, both laid on their backs as though they had been positioned. Tim, Laura's dad, had the feeling that Laura's murder and Heidi's murder were connected, since they were both last seen at the exact same payphone. When he brought this to police, they told him that Heidi was an isolated incident and that she worked at a bar and someone had taken her out after she got off work and killed her. They told him, "Don't go talking to Heidi's family. They're trying to get over her loss." Police also told the Fies not to speak to the Millers in regards to their daughter's murder. Police tried their best to convince Tim Miller that he had lost his mind. Looking back, Tim wishes that he would have just gone with his gut and spoke to Heidi's family, and maybe the medical examiner could have gotten to her sooner to figure out the cause of death, and maybe there would have been some kind of evidence that could have given police a clue as to who was doing this.
Shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Well, it's clear that hindsight. It was probably a serial killer, considering the bodies were kind of staged and posed.
Right. And they were, like, filmed really close to each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So the Millers lived just two doors down from Clyde Hedrick himself, and Tim said that Laura was scared of Clyde. One of Laura's friends would go walking with her around her neighborhood, and they would walk away from Clyde's house because Laura said that she was scared. That friend still calls Tim to this day, as of the Netflix docuseries, though he denies any involvement in her murder. Tim said that Clyde was on his radar as soon as he learned of Ellen Beeson. It was at this point that people were realizing that this could be the work of a serial killer, and it was something that was really happening in their community. 5 years later, some horseback riders stumbled upon a fourth body in the same field. Unfortunately, the police were not able to identify those either, so she became Janet Doe. Her remains were found about 100 yards from where the remains of the other bodies were discovered. Close enough for her to possibly be connected to the other three, but far enough away that police couldn't be sure. The medical examiner said that it appeared that Janet Doe had been beaten to death by a club. She was presumed to be between the ages of 30 to 50. Police believed that this was the work of one killer as opposed to two or more because all four bodies were positioned in the same manner, left naked against a tree with their arms folded. But police couldn't exactly rule it out either, because not only were there no witnesses, there weren't even any common links between the deceased women.
But that's common with serial killers. There's no common link,
right,
between the victims.
They just be picking.
They really are. Other than, like, maybe skin color or...
sex.
Well...
like, age sometimes.
Age. Sometimes you'll see, like, hair color be a factor.
So, Tim Miller had a few suspects in his mind of who killed his daughter, Laura, and the other three women, one of them being Clyde Hedrick. Donna Marie Prudhomme was last seen in July 1991 in Nassau Bay, Texas. On September 8th, 1991, a local resident came across her badly decomposed body in a field beside Calder Road. A medical examination concluded that she had died at least 6 weeks prior, yet a cause of death could not be determined. She was identified in April 2019 along with Audrey Cook by Family Tree DNA with the use of genetic genealogy. On February 1st, 1996, Lynette Bibbs, 14, and Tamara Fisher, 15, visited a Houston, Texas club for teenagers. A 22-year-old male later claimed to have dropped the friends off at a motel near the city center on Old Spanish Trail.
That's never a good sign when you have two teenage girls getting dropped off in a motel, dude.
By a 22-year-old.
Yeah. Yikes. At a teen nightclub.
Yeah, I was not allowed to go to our local teen nightclub when I was
younger. Good fucking reason. Like,
not fucking allowed.
I went one time, and my mom dropped me off, and then she came and picked me up. She's like, "Yeah, that'll be the last time you go." And I was like, "Why?" And she's like, "Because I walked in there and just, like, stood at the top of the stairs and watched, and I was, like, horrified." I was "Why?"
Well, my dad was a club DJ around here for, like, a really long time. So he knows what the fuck going on. He was like, absolutely not. Mm-mm. So The bodies of the two girls were found dumped by a rural road 2 days later on February 3rd, 1996, in Cleveland, Texas. They had both been shot to death, but police suspect by different people. In 1997, a new terror moved into the Texas killing field. His name was William Lewis Reese.
Woo, shout out.
This dude is wackadoo cuckoo for fucking Cocoa Puffs crazy.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, this guy is a goddamn menace.
So after serving nearly 10 years in prison for sexually assaulting two women in his native Oklahoma, William Reese was released from prison in the fall of 1996. After his release, Reese briefly stayed with his mother in Anadarko, Oklahoma, before moving to Harris County, Texas, where he found work as a farrier, which means putting shoes on horses, and a construction worker. Reese made frequent trips between his new home in Texas and his mother's home in Oklahoma in 1997. In the May of 1997, 19-year-old Sandra Sapaw, who was pregnant with her third child, threw herself out of a moving truck that was speeding down I-45. A woman in the car behind the truck pulled over and took Sandra to the hospital. She tried to recount the events of the night, but her memory was foggy. She said she was at a gas station with a slashed tire. Sapaw says that she noticed a man staring at her in the parking lot, and when she saw him again at the Waffle House restaurant across the street, he offered his help, but then he whipped out a knife and forced Sandra into his truck.
Never accept help from a man at a Waffle House.
Never. Fucking that's never.
That's just never a good sign. And this is back when you couldn't tell. No. This is back when you couldn't tell if the pepper on your eggs was actually pepper or cigarette ashes.
Right, right.
Because all the cooks were just chain smoking and would have a cherry about 2 inches long.
That gives it the flavor.
Does it?
It does.
Smoked waffle.
Mm. Is that a Newport button there I see?
No. A little bit extra. She recalled the events, but not the details, such as who the man was. It wasn't until several months later when police attempted a round of hypnosis in hopes that she would jog her memory. Sandra was able to get the license plate number of the truck from the session.
That's insane that they used hypnosis.
Yeah, that's crazy.
In the 90s, that was like...
I wonder if it was the correct license plate number, though.
See, I can barely remember my own fucking license plate number. You know what I'm saying?
I definitely don't know mine. Like, not even a little bit.
Yeah.
You
all right over there, bud?
I'm literally suffering and struggling over here.
Yeah.
I just don't
know. There. There you go. That's
a good time. But then that happens.
It's okay.
What?
That noise. You guys want to hear me put my white claw down?
Well, there ain't no laws when you're drinking claws.
Nope. So. All right. So Sandra Sapaw was just the tip of the iceberg that is William Reese. In 2015, a DNA match was made that connected William to the murder of a 19-year-old newlywed named Tiffany Johnston, who was found dead in Oklahoma in 1997. William was then extradited back to Oklahoma, found guilty of Tiffany's murder, and risked facing the needle. He made one final Hail Mary and offered the authorities the full truth in order to avoid the death penalty. William told authorities that in the summer of 1997, he murdered three girls in the area surrounding the Texas killing fields. His first was April 3rd, 1997. She was a 12-year-old girl named Laura Smither, an aspiring ballerina from the quiet town of Friendswood who was out for a morning jog. The police jumped right in and began a search for her. Police, the FBI, and even a team of Marines joined the search. Her naked body was found 17 days later, on April 20th, by two men who were running their dogs by a retention pond near Pasadena.
Hell yeah, bruh, 420.
Huh?
April 20th, 420.
Oh my goodness.
Smoke 'em if you got 'em.
Smoke 'em if you got 'em. In July 15th, 1997, Kelly Cox, a 20-year-old mother and student at the University of Northern Texas, was taking a tour of the Denton Police Department as a part of her criminal justice class, but left early to take an exam. Shortly after leaving, Cox discovered that she was locked out of her car and used a payphone at a nearby gas station to call her boyfriend for help.
Dude. These girls gotta stop using payphones in Texas. For
fucking real, Jesus dude.
Christ. A payphone is like the signal flare.
I know they had guys. Car phones by then.
You know what? I was just sitting here thinking, I don't think I've ever used a payphone in my whole life. I've seen them.
Yeah, I don't think I have either.
Well, most of them were gone by the time we were like young adults and shit.
I think my parents had like a landline.
You know, yeah, but I mean, there was payphone booths in my neighborhood, but they took them all down by like 2001. Yeah.
I was born in 98, so.
Yeah, you're a youngin'.
Hee.
You're a baby.
I'm just a baby. So, shortly after leaving, I already said that. So she used a payphone at a nearby gas station to call her boyfriend for help. But when he showed up, Cox was nowhere to be found. Later that day, when Kelly failed to pick her toddler up from daycare, Cox's mother, Jan Bynum, says she knew something was terribly wrong. Kelly Cox was a dedicated student, taking summer classes and hoped to graduate early with a degree in social work. Although Kelly was a young mother to her daughter Alexis, she embraced it fully. Alexis was her whole world, and Kelly's mother, Jan Bynum, knew that Kelly would never leave Alexis behind. Still, the days of searching turned into weeks, and despite her best efforts, Bynum couldn't figure out exactly what happened to her daughter. With no body and no strong leads, the case began to grow cold. In July 26, 1997, Tiffany Johnston was 19 years old and newly married when she vanished in broad daylight from a car wash in Bethany, Oklahoma. Her floor mats were still hanging on the drying racks and keys were still in the ignition, but there was no sign of Tiffany and no one at the car wash reported seeing anything out of the ordinary that day. Tiffany's mother, Kathy Dobry, was left mystified and wondered what happened to her youngest daughter. Just a day after her disappearance, Tiffany's partially clothed body was found in tall grass next to an unpaved rural road close to the interstate. It was just 15 miles from the car wash where she was last seen alive. She had been strangled and sexually assaulted. Investigators were able to recover the killer's DNA from Johnson's body, but they could not develop a suspect profile from it at the time. Just 3 weeks after Tiffany Johnson's murder, 17-year-old Jessica Kane was last seen leaving a restaurant in Clear Lake, Texas, where she was out with friends. When Jessica missed curfew, her father, C.H. Kane, went out looking for her.
That's a badass name, dude.
Yeah, I was just thinking that's a cool name. After searching for hours, C.H. Kane found his daughter's truck abandoned on the shoulder of I-45 just a couple of miles from their home. There was no trace of Jessica and no clues as to where she was. Search parties and friends looked for any sign of her, but they had no luck. Gay and Bob Smither, who were still processing the loss of their own daughter, Laura, just 4 months earlier, joined the search immediately, saying that they felt called by God to help. After weeks of searching for answers, once again, investigators were left without leads and Jessica's case grew cold. 5 months after Sandra Sapaw's abduction, during a meeting with Friendswood Police, Webster investigators realized that Sapaw's description of her kidnapper's vehicle sounded similar to the truck Friendswood Police had searched in Laura Smither's case, belonging to William Reese. On October 16, 1997, Reese was pulled in for a lineup and Sapaw identified him as her attacker. 5 months after Sandra Sapaw's abduction, during a meeting with Friendswood Police, Webster's investigators...
You all right, bud?
It's the same paragraph.
Well, goddamn.
Okay. So, police immediately arrested William and charged him with kidnapping.
Sorry, we may have already read this. Everybody...
He still insisted that the situation was just a misunderstanding. He said, "I'm not a rapist. I'm just an old country boy." Ew.
Grimy, dude.
Yuck.
That gives me.
I ain't no rapist. I'm just a good old country boy, man.
God. That makes me grossed out.
That is
gross. That's what I like about them high school girls, man. I keep getting older and they just stay the same age. Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Oh, my God. When William Reese was put on trial for the kidnapping of Sandra Sapaw on April 29th, 1998, his past came back to haunt him. The jury heard Sandra Sapaw's powerful testimony, and his victims from the 80s also took the stand and shared how they were both brutally attacked by Reese in Oklahoma. The jury deliberated for less than 3 hours before they found Reese guilty. He was then sentenced to 60 years in prison. In 2012, retired police chief Lynn Williams had started working for the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigations and was assigned to Tiffany Johnson's case. Williams went through the case file methodically and came to think the crime scene DNA was their best bet at identifying her killer. The DNA from Johnson's body had already been tested twice with no results, but with advancements in DNA testing, OSBI supervising criminologist Wendy Duke and her team were able to develop a partial male profile. The team compared the partial profile to the profiles from known suspects and eliminated all other suspects until they got to William Reese. In December of 2013, a buccal swab was, do you guys know what that is?
A swab that's buccal.
No fucking way. All right. Creeps in the Crypt, always the informative podcast.
Hell yeah, dude. We're
always here to help. So that was collected from William Reese. And I was trying to like, because if I don't know, I'm sure nobody.
I didn't do these fucking notes.
A lot of people probably.
Also known as a buccal smear is a way to collect DNA from the cells on the inside of the person's cheeks.
Oh, a mouth swab. Like steak and blowjob
why
day.
Like steak and blowjob day. Baby, you want to do a buccal swab tonight? That's what I'm going to start calling it now.
Yes or no, Christian?
I didn't say no.
Hell yeah.
Moving swiftly along. All right. So a buccal swab was collected from William Reese and sent to the OSBI for comparison. With his DNA in hand, Wendy Duke was finally able to connect Reese to the DNA recovered from Tiffany's body, and Reese could not be eliminated as the contributor. On September 22nd, 2015, an arrest warrant was issued for William Reese by the state of Oklahoma for the murder and kidnapping of Tiffany Johnston. Oklahoma law enforcement shared their new DNA discovery with Texas investigators who wondered if they could get Reese to talk about a potential connection to the cases of Laura Smither, Kelly Cox, and Jessica Kane. Investigators from Texas went to visit Reese in prison. But before he agreed to speak further, he wanted the death penalty taken off the table. The Smithers agreed, and Jan Bynum agreed. They all hoped to learn what happened to their daughters. Despite only having an agreement to waive the death penalty for Kelly Cox and Laura Smithers' cases, William Reese ended up confessing to all four murders. William gave police the locations as to where they could find the bodies. With the help of some information from William Reese, after 25 days of digging, Jessica Kane's remains were discovered in a field on East Orem Drive near Hobby Airport. Jessica Kane's parents asked for privacy while they buried their daughter. 2 weeks after her remains were unearthed, Kelly Cox's were also found in nearby Brazoria County. After so many years of wondering what happened to her daughter and Alexis's mother, Jan Bynum now had answers. Kelly's bracelet was found with her remains, and Jan had it made into a locket. After William Reese led investigators to Kelly Cox and Jessica Kane's remains, Oklahoma prosecutors wanted Reese transported to Oklahoma so he could face charges for the murder and kidnapping of Tiffany Johnston. Even though prosecutors had DNA linking him to Tiffany Johnston and his confession, Reese entered a plea of not guilty. After 9 days, the jury deliberated and took less than 2 hours to find Reese guilty of murder murdering Tiffany Johnston. He was sentenced to death. I'm confused. I thought they couldn't.
He didn't get the death penalty for the Texas murders. But they sentenced him to death for the Oklahoma shit.
Well, that's silly. He's going to die anyway. What was the point?
Wasting tax dollars.
Yeah.
I also don't understand, like, and obviously I'm not saying let's get into it, but I don't understand, like, the five life sentences, three life sentences, like, what?
Just in case you, like...
reincarnate?
Like, no. What? Think about it like this. Say you die and they resuscitate you. Technically, you could use that as a fucking loophole.
No way.
I mean, I would.
I wonder if that's ever happened before.
I don't know, but
that's... Somebody Google it and tell us.
That's why they get, like, fucking consecutive life
sentences. I don't think that's why. That's really why.
I mean, that's where my brain's at. I don't know if that's true or not, but if I was convicted of, like, one life sentence, I would find some way to, like...
Yeah, I'm going to kill myself, and then you guys have to save me, and then I'm going,
like,
to leave.
Yeah, I'm going to, like, OD in front of, like, the cop. CO. Yeah, the CO, and they're going to resuscitate me, and I'm like,
oopsie.
I was legally dead.
A life sentence carries... or equates to any sentence that carries a minimum of 25 years, after which time the individual or may or not be granted parole. A life sentence without parole is... So it depends on if they can get paroled or not, is basically... That's the reasoning behind it, is... So, I guess...
So they get an opportunity to be paroled.
So if they give them three,
then they do 25, 25... 25 and then they can parole?
Yes, but by then, if they're like, and even if they're in like their 20s, you do 25, 25, they're going to be dead by the time, or...
Yeah, they make sure you're not getting out.
It's kind of like...
Why don't they just do...
Because but a lot of the times they do with no possibility of parole too. It's a sticky fucking wicket.
I hate it here.
Basically what it said is the reason why they do that is to... deter without parole, because it's easier to get three life consecutive sentences from a judge versus life without parole, I guess. I'm assuming. I don't know. I don't know law like that, but that's what it is. So 25 years is what the minimum...
I still like my idea.
My brain feels like it's playing Twister.
All I could think of was that
movie.
Are
you on the red dots or the green ones?
I thought they were blue.
Well, there's blue in there, too.
Oh, well, why'd you only give me two fucking options?
And I yellow. Didn't bring that into the... I was trying to give you two options instead of multiple. There's yellow in there,
too. You're trying not to hurt my head?
Yeah, there's yellow.
Okay, I'm going to read now. Okay.
That was a fun side quest.
Yeah, side quest complete. Oh. Half completed.
We kind of got
we
there.
We gave up. Yeah. We died. All right, so...
Was it consecutive?
Yeah. All right. So, Reese returned to Texas to face justice in the murders of Laura Smither, Kelly Cox, and Jessica Kane. 25 years after the murders of Laura Smither, Kelly Cox, and Jessica Kane, their families finally got their day in court. William Reese pleaded guilty in Galveston and Brazoria counties and was given three life sentences, one for each murder. Interesting. We just said that. There will always be the possibility that he will be sent back to Oklahoma. And if that happens, he will likely be executed. To this day, there's little to no information about the open cases in the Texas killing fields. FBI and police were able to identify some of the people responsible for the murders that took place there. However, the person or people responsible for murdering four women between 1984 to 1991 is no closer to being brought to justice than they were back then. We are happy to tell you that not all of the questions from those cases have been left unanswered. Back in 2019, Jane and Janet Doe were both identified over 30 years after their remains were found. Jane Doe, who was found the same day as Laura Lynn, is now identified as 30-year-old Audrey Lee Cook. And Janet Doe, the one from the horseback riders that they found, is now identified as 34-year-old Donna Gonsulin Prudhomme. What a name. Audrey Audrey was a mechanic who was working in the Houston area and was last seen alive in December of 1985. She was shot to death by a .22 caliber gun. Donna was a young mother of two who had just escaped her abusive husband, according to her sister Diane, and was down on her luck. Diane told the FBI she had a pretty tough life, but she loved her children so much, and you know, we just do the best we can with what we have. Donna found happiness after she left her husband. However, it was short-lived. She hit some roadblocks and ultimately took her children to live with her mother. Diane last spoke to Donna in 1989 when she asked for her birth certificate for her travel plans and was never seen or heard from again. There are suspects in both cases, but no one has ever been officially named or linked to the murders. And as the years pass, it gets more and more difficult to pin down suspects and motives. Authorities have considered the possibility of transients being the culprits of these murders, known serial killers such as Henry Lee Lucas, although we know that he would confess to killing the Lindbergh baby.
Yeah, that dude, I can't wait to cover him. He confesses to everything.
Right. Crimes of opportunity and more. But overall, the police believe that this is the handiwork of just one serial killer. Special Agent Richard Renison, who has investigated the Texas killing fields for over 10 years, said, "With that much time going by, people lose their memories, people pass away, people just simply forget. It's hard to remember significant details from that long ago." Thankfully, Agent Renison hasn't given up on the investigation. He said it may be labeled a cold case, but that doesn't mean it's sitting on a shelf and isn't being worked. It's being actively worked at the FBI and actively at the League City Police Department. Anything anyone in the public knows, no matter how small they think it is, we really want them to come forward because it may be very significant to us. Jessica Dimmock said, "These stories would not be on our radar if it wasn't for these family members demanding answers and keeping it relevant and continuing to ask questions and continuing to knock on the door and being like, why haven't you solved this? It's not because the police are coming out with new information. It's about the family members' incredible dedication over many, many years." Heidi's father spent the rest of his life trying to figure out what happened to her that day and died before he could get an answer. He would go out and drive clear across town without telling anyone in the family. He would go to nightclubs and interview anyone who would stop and talk to him. Then he would sit down and get his tape recorder out and recount everything that they had talked about, what the person looked like that he had spoke to, all of it. On one of his recordings, he said, "I know damn well someone knows something." Heidi's sister Josie told Texas Monthly, "Even when he was on his deathbed, he brought the family together and made us promise that we would never give up the search for her killer." Laura Lynn's father, Tim Miller, is still out for justice for his daughter as well. He founded Texas EcuSearch, which is a search and rescue organization to help find missing people. He's really been the one at the forefront of everything with the searches, not only in the Texas killing fields, but his search and rescue business has gone to over 40 states and given aid to missing person searches. Today, the field is owned by a church and is no longer as remote as it used to be. It's now across from a housing development and now has a paved road. There's a memorial site for each of the four victims from 1983 to 1991 to acknowledge the awful things that happened there and honor the women whose lives were cut short.
And that's where we're going to end it for this episode. Now, we're going to have a short formed episode as just like an addendum to this series, like a part three, but like a mini part three. And then next week we are also doing the Toy Box Killer.
Yo.
So we are getting hot and heavy.
For real.
So I can't wait for that. I'm very fucking excited.
We're bringing
excited.
Kidnapping. We're bringing BDSM.
Bestiality.
Yeah, bestiality.
It's all on the table next week. So
it's all on the tapes.
I might just record
the tapes.
His entire tape.
You definitely should.
And put it out as like a bonus episode.
It's so interesting.
But yeah, guys, thank you for listening. And we hope you enjoyed the series on the Texas killing fields. Like I said, there will be an addendum, like little mini episode, because we still have some stuff left, but we're at the 40-minute mark, and that's where we like to cut it off. So We said, fuck it. We'll just do a mini episode for next week.
Fuck it in a bucket.
That way, if this is a topic that doesn't interest you at all, you don't have to listen to it.
You can go straight to the Toy Box Killer.
We can go straight to some blood and gore. So, more blood and gore than this. Jesus. But yeah, thank you guys. Christian, go ahead and drop those socials for me, please.
We appreciate you guys. We love you so much. thank you guys so much for the follows, the likes, the shares, everything. It means a lot to all of us. Make sure you guys are following us on all the socials.
Apparently, it's just Instagram and Facebook.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Somebody decided to take a sabbatical from social media.
I deleted Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, every social media except for Snapchat for my mental health. And then Eric looked at me earlier and said, so that's why we don't have any TikToks. And I was like, holy fuck. TikTok has not been in my headspace because I've been...
Doesn't matter. The shit got banned anyway.
Huh?
Yeah, Congress voted to ban TikTok.
I will literally run into traffic, and I mean it.
Who gives a fuck? You deleted it?
I just re-fucking downloaded it. I love TikTok. That's where I post my singing vids.
Mm. Well, now... Blame
How
the government.
Am I going to be able to watch a movie in 12 episodes?
Yeah. While somebody plays Subway Surfer at the bottom.
Why do you have to call me out like that? And it's not usually Subway Surfer. They're usually like some kind of like 5-minute craft in the bottom corner.
Yeah,
too.
Or that's like usually... satisfying videos. Yes. Sand videos.
Yes.
Anyway.
Do you know how many times I've watched The Help on TikTok? Too many times.
All right, guys. Well, that's where we're going to end it this week. Stay spooky.
And stay creepy.
Stay strange.
Bye. Huh?